I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The top lawyer for Hewlett-Packard resigned today, just hours before hearings began on Capitol Hill looking into the Hewlett-Packard scandal involving private eyes masquerading as journalists, sifting through employees' garbage and sending bogus email to reporters to try to find out whether board members were leaking information to the press. But today's House Energy and Commerce Committee hearings, featuring testimony by Hewlett-Packard's former chair and current CEO, is broader than just the company's scandal. It's a greater examination of corporate ethics and the legality of some questionable investigative practices. Lorraine Woolard is the Washington correspondent for Business Week. She attended this morning's hearings. I understand we just had Lorraine on the line. She's at the hearings and had stepped out, but have we lost that line? Oh, we have lost that line. So you know what we're going to do? We'll put that on hold and hear more about Hewlett-Packard going to the woodshed, or rather to Capitol Hill. But first, we're going to turn to Jonathan Turley. Jonathan Turley is going to help us this morning, this afternoon, talk about the Supreme Court agenda. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to decide a question about union dues, whether public employee unions must get special permission before spending some of those dues on political causes. And that's just one of the issues that justices are going to take up when the High Court's next term starts next week. Justices begin on Tuesday, considering whether green card holders who commit crimes should be deported. From there, they're going to go on to debate a rare late-term abortion procedure, also greenhouse gas emissions, school racial preferences, much more. So we want to spend a few minutes on that today with Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University. Jonathan, welcome.
Hi.
And what is your big-picture view of this upcoming court session, dominated by one issue, one person? What's your overall first?
Well, first of all, it's a truly sort of dim sum plate. It has a little bit of everything,
right.
But it has the potential for being a very significant term. The reason is that we now have, of course, both Alito and Roberts who will be on for the full term, and many of these issues are involve areas where the loss of O'Connor could well flip the result. Alito, mm-hmm. who replaced O'Connor, is very, very consistent in voting for the government on criminal cases. He tends to vote against environmental challenges. And we have a bunch of those. Now, the most important will probably be the partial birth abortion cases.
Well, in fact, let's take a look at that. There are two cases focusing on the constitutionality of the 2003 Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act. This ban outlawed the rare late-term abortion procedures in which a fetus is extracted or evacuated in ways that supporters say is sometimes medically necessary, opponents say is infanticide. The opponents won in that federal ban, but then a lower court struck down the federal ban. Now, why was that?
Well, first of all, this involves, when we talk about late-term abortions, we're talking about pregnancies in the 21st week. There's about 18,000 abortions that occur at the end of what's called the second trimester. And in this case, the lower court rejected the congressional record that said that you did not have to consider these health issues involving the mother in the legislation. You don't have to have an exception for that.
Right. This was one of the biggest concerns, that there was no exception for a mother's health.
That's right. And what Judge Coff in the case said from the U.S. District Court is that he didn't buy the record, that he said there was, quote, remarkably little substantive information in the record for Congress to make that factual finding. So what we have here is really a frontal attack on the previous ruling by the court in 2000 in a case called Stenberg involving Nebraska's partial birth abortion. And this is really a case that was crafted for the new Supreme Court. There's a notable difference. Sitting in Sandra Day O'Connor's chair, the key vote, is Sam Alito.
Well, now it gets further complicated because some people say this case is more about the procedure. Even conservatives who are very much against late-term abortion are also for, some of them, states' rights. So they're against a federal ban on something that they think should be decided at the state level, whereas I read someone say you're closer to the people and issues like a mother's health. So that does that complicate it in your mind as well?
Well, it does, but I'm not too sure that will carry the day. The conservatives on this court have tended to favor these types of bans, but you're absolutely right. The fact that this heralds from Congress and not a given state adds a federalism issue. And indeed, that may be just enough to eke out the one vote that they're going to need. And so they're going to be making a lot of pitches towards someone like Justice Kennedy in this case.
Right. Do you think that any direct challenge to Roe v. Wade will come up in this court term? I mean, some would see this as a chipping away at Roe v. Wade, but do you think there will be a direct challenge?
Well, you know, one of the most telling things that came out of the Alito confirmation hearings, there wasn't a lot telling otherwise, is that when he was a Justice Department attorney, he encouraged the administration not to do a frontal assault on Roe v. Wade, but to essentially kill it with 1,000 paper cuts. And so you have on the court Alito and Roberts, who are not inclined to just overturn Roe v. Wade, but would prefer to gradually reduce it to, frankly, nothing if they could, in my view. And so I don't think you're going to see that type of bold overturning. But if the partial birth abortion law is upheld, I think that Roe v. Wade is in serious trouble ultimately, particularly because you have John Paul Stevens, who is quite old, and he's holding that liberal majority. And liberals, you know, are careful. They don't drop boxes around them because this guy is all they've got on that court. And so a lot of people think that Roberts and Alito are really biding their time. If they're going to take out Roe v. Wade, it's probably not going to occur with the current court, but after someone like Stevens is replaced.
Hmm. Okay, so that's number one on the agenda. The justices are also going to take up two cases involving school racial diversity. Let's move to that topic. It involves cases in Louisville, Kentucky, and Seattle. In Louisville, some parents there are angry that students are being bused up to 3 hours a day to balance the school's racial mixture. In Seattle, race is one factor in a very complicated formula schools use to maintain racial balance, and a white mother and her white son tried to get into a school that they felt was a better school, but his race was a part of the formula that blocked him from entering that school because of the balance that school was keeping. So what do these cases open up for us?
Well, once again, these are cases that are quite fundamental and seem to be selected by the new conservative majority. I think the Seattle case is the more interesting of the two. It goes directly to the court's 2003 decisions called in Grutter and Gratz, mm-hmm. in which the Supreme Court, in case of the University of Michigan Law School, upheld an admissions policy that included a racial determinant. But then in Gratz, they struck down a policy from the Michigan undergrad mm-hmm. that said they put too much importance on race. Those decisions have been criticized, particularly Justice O'Connor's decision, which seemed to be very sort of policy-oriented. There's no question in my mind that Roberts and Alito would not support those decisions.
Well, and by the way, just to help us out here, because we're, you know, some people are stretching our memory banks, if you could just briefly and simply, what was the difference? In other words, why was the law school upheld?
Well, the law school was upheld because it was more nuanced. That is, race was just one of the factors that could be considered for diversity. They considered other diversity issues. On the undergrad, it just was viewed by the court as being too significant, too determinative, and that they needed a more nuanced approach like the law school. Now, in this case, you have the question of a high school, which adds a new dimension. But also, you're dealing with a court that was very closely divided back in 2003. And once again, you have the replacement of O'Connor with Alito. And so many of us are looking at whether this case might significantly cut back on those 2003 rulings or even overturn them. I think Sam Alito has considerable intestinal fortitude on issues of this kind. He is much more likely to agree with those people challenging these types of racial distinctions.
Okay. Well, okay, racial diversity, another case. For those of you keeping score at home, we'll move on to the third topic, the environment, and a big environmental issue, whether the EPA has the authority to regulate power plant emissions that cause climate-changing greenhouse gases. The agency, the EPA, says it doesn't. States are lining up on both sides of the issue. We've been watching California. An example of what's being contested is, for instance, northeastern states are impacted by emissions blowing from southern or midwestern states. So you know, what? Tell us more about this case and what impact it's going to have on states that are saying, you know what, we don't think the feds are doing enough, we're going to do it ourselves.
Well, it's a very interesting case because you have 12 states, including states like Massachusetts, California, New York, a bunch of cities, even American Samoa, who are coming in and saying, look, the EPA is doing nothing, and we have a serious problem here, and we want to force them to start to regulate greenhouse gases under what's called Section 202 of the Clean Air Act. And basically, that section has very general language that the EPA can regulate any air pollutant that, quote, reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare. And so they're saying, look, what do you think global warming is? The interesting thing about this case is that the EPA has taken originally a position like George Bush's, questioning the causal connection between these pollutants and global warming. In the last couple of years, the administration has begun to back away from that. I mean, the scientific community is virtually unanimous in terms of the respected science that there is this relation. But this case has kept chugging along in its original state, and the administration has not changed its position. It's very hard to force an agency to, frankly, do its job, to you know, regulate pollutants. And so it's going to be a hard sell. And once again, it's going to be a lot harder with this court. Both Roberts and Alito have pretty strong records against environmental claims. They tend to be, at least in my view, and I think many views, somewhat antagonistic towards these types of claims.
So, for instance, in California, where just yesterday Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed rules that would force car makers to improve vehicle emissions and mileage, much higher than federal standards. That case, some people were thinking that that case would embarrass, the current administration or maybe the courts into being tougher. But you're saying they don't care. No, you laugh.
Well, they have a very high threshold for embarrassment, and it is fascinating that the EPA was created to essentially force states to seriously consider environmental problems. We had this patchwork system of a lot of states that just weren't protecting their citizens. And what a reversal of fortune now that, you know, the EPA is now viewed as the choke point, that it's preventing states. It actually has moved against many of these states to prevent them from taking their own action against global warming and other types of environmental pollutants. And so it's a fascinating, turnaround where the EPA is viewed and the administration is viewed as the villain, keeping states from, frankly, making sacrifices and saying, look, we're prepared to make some sacrifices for the benefit of the planet and the benefit of the health of our citizens.
Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University, looking at some of the agenda of the Supreme Court this year. Jonathan, we want to have you back to look further. Will you do that for us?
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Some American consumers want Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez to pay for calling President Bush the devil and an alcoholic, among other things, while addressing the UN General Assembly last week. This week, 7-Eleven announced it will stop selling gas from the Venezuelan-owned Citgo Petroleum Company. 7-Eleven now says it has been planning to switch gasoline suppliers for a year, but in its press release, the company sympathized with many Americans' concerns over derogatory comments made by Chavez. Also, a Boston city councilor called for replacing that city's landmark Citgo sign with a fluorescent American flag. And some conservative bloggers urged people to boycott Citgo stations. Well, Republican State Representative Adam Hastner of Florida also has chimed in. He wants his state, Florida, to break its exclusive contract with Citgo at its highway service stops. Representative Hastner joins us on the line. And first of all, are you just trying to make a symbolic point? Or do you really expect Florida to break its contract with, the 7 Citgo stations on Florida's 300-mile highway?
Well, here in Florida, our turnpike, which is our toll road, is lined with Citgo gas stations at our rest areas. And I've called upon our Department of Transportation to terminate this exclusive fuel service provider contract with Citgo.
Do you think that that's really possible?
I do believe it's possible. Florida taxpayers should not have to support institutions like Citgo and the Venezuelan government, institutions that are seeking to destabilize America.
What are you hearing from your constituents?
We've had overwhelming response and support of this initiative. Florida taxpayers understand that their money shouldn't be going to institutions and to places like Hugo Chavez that are seeking to destabilize America, that are making outrageous remarks about our way of life, attacking our freedoms, attacking our values. And Florida taxpayers don't have to support that.
How is what someone says destabilizing the U.S.?
These aren't just words. His actions are speaking much more clearly. And what we need to do is make sure that he doesn't have the ability to interrupt our economic security or to destabilize us in any other way.
What do you mean? Are you talking about the oil flow?
Whether he wants to take different actions that could have certain impacts on our economy through oil flow or through the backing of any type of terrorism or the backing of any other types of actions seeking to hurt us here in the United States.
We note that you are talking exclusively about the contract that Florida has with the Citgo stations. You're not calling for a boycott as others are, but this is still a little reminiscent, I'm sure you're aware, of the Freedom Fries campaign in 2003 when Americans, many of them, were upset with France's opposition to the war in Iraq. And as you know, that campaign sort of fizzled out, and some were saying, you know, these calls for either boycotting Citgo or breaking contracts, won't Americans just buy the cheapest gas they can find? And if Citgo is it, they will go there.
And I respect individuals' rights to go to whatever gas station they want and purchase gas, but this is a wake-up call in the larger issue that I've been fighting for here in Florida, which is the need to develop alternative fuels and rid our addiction of foreign oil. We can't afford to put our energy future into the hands of people like Hugo Chavez and other countries that are seeking to destabilize the United States.
Well, what do you think, sir, though, of the fact that many states are welcoming Hugo Chavez's oil? He has a program that offers more than 1 million low-income residents discounted home heating oil, offering 100 million gallons of oil to low-income residents here in Massachusetts, in New York, Minnesota, Alaska. Do you think he should be applauded on that level for offering oil to low-income Americans?
I'm not going to question his motivations on this issue. I just know that he is a man that we cannot trust here in the United States. He has every intention of seeking to destabilize our country, and we need, here in the state of Florida, we need to terminate our contract with Citgo on our Florida Turnpike. We don't need to have an exclusive provider contract with Citgo on Florida's Turnpike.
That's Republican State Representative Adam Hassner of Florida, who wants that state to break its contract, which allows Citgo to be the exclusive gas station on that state's turnpikes. Representative Hassner, thanks very much.
Have a great day.
Well, what impact, if any, will these consumer actions against Citgo have? We decided to call Here Now's resident oil expert, Vahan Janjigian, executive director of the Forbes Investor Advisory Institute, to ask him. Vahan, what do you think? Will the efforts to break a state contract, to, you know, calls for boycotts, will these actually impact Citgo?
Well, yeah, they certainly send a message. You know, I kind of view this thing from two points of view. You know, Vahan the economist and Vahan the American. And the economist in me says that, you know, these boycotts and these kinds of actions may actually end up hurting us more than they hurt Venezuela, because Citgo, for example, employs about 2,000 Americans at its Lake Charles refinery alone. And many of these people you know, could be out of work if the boycott is really successful. And in the long run, you know, we're going to have to buy gasoline. So if we don't buy gasoline from Citgo, we're going to have to buy gasoline from somebody else. And the American refiners are already fairly stretched, which basically means we would have to import more gasoline. And Citgo will simply sell its gasoline someplace else. So I don't think the economic boycott would have a big impact on Citgo. Now, Vahan the American says, I'm all for this boycott because I am really offended at what Hugo Chavez said, and I thought it was completely inappropriate for him to personally attack President Bush at the United Nations and to call for the overthrow of the U.S. government.
I can hear the passion in your voice, Vahan, but as an oil analyst, isn't this idea of, you know, provoking someone like Hugo Chavez, something that could be as dangerous for Americans in the long run?
Well, no, I don't think so, because if we were to boycott Venezuelan oil or Venezuelan gasoline, it may hurt Venezuela's profits in the short term, but because demand is so strong for petroleum products around the world, Venezuela will simply do what Iran does and find other buyers.
While we have you, Vahan Jenjigian, we want to ask you about the price of gas. The average price fell by 12 cents a gallon last week to $2.50, the lowest it's been since the end of March. There have been some theories abounding that this low gas price is part of a conspiracy between oil companies and Republicans to lower the prices right before an election. Is that something that can be manipulated? Is that possible?
No, I really don't believe that's possible at all. In fact, I always laugh when I hear these conspiracies because the oil companies, first of all, are a very small player in the world oil market. The big players are countries like Saudi Arabia. And if the Republicans could have lowered the price of gasoline, I'm sure they would have done it a long time ago.
Vahan Jenjigian, Executive Director of the Forbes Investor Advisory Institute. Vahan, thanks as always for your thoughts, your two hats today, an American and an oil analyst. Vahan, thanks.
Thank you, Robin.
And we'll have more on the theories of an October surprise later in the program. Much more coming up here and now. Robin Young, it's here and now. Hewlett-Packard executives are testifying on Capitol Hill today. As we mentioned earlier, the top lawyer for Hewlett-Packard resigned today just hours before those hearings were to begin. It's a scandal involving private eyes based here in Boston, masquerading as journalists, sifting through employees' garbage, faking their names in order to get private phone information, all to try to find out whether board members were leaking information to reporters. David Kaplan, senior editor at Newsweek magazine, has been following the hearings today. He joins us. And David, first of all, it sounds as if a lot of people are taking the fifth. What are some of the things that are actually being said at today's hearings?
Well, the first panel of witnesses all took the fifth, including most notably Ann Baskins, who until this morning was the company's general counsel. She resigned this morning, probably because she was about to take the Fifth Amendment, and it's hard to be the head lawyer of a company when you're invoking your right against self-incrimination. The other witnesses who took the fifth were various and private investigators and consultants who HP had hired to look into leaks. Testifying now are Patty Dunn, the former chairman of the board, who's really been in the center of this storm, and Larry Sensini, who's the company's outside counsel, and then a couple of other witnesses. But I think the most critical witness is the witness so far is Patty Dunn, the chairman of the board, who is defending the ends of the investigation, that is, uncovering leaks from the boardroom, even though she has continue to apologize now quite vociferously for the means used.
What is she saying about that defense? What is she saying about defending, you know, what did she find? What is the defense?
Well, as she has said in the past in interviews with us and others, she has said that the leaks coming out of the boardroom were destructive to the company. The fact of the leaks, because board members, directors, will thereby not be open and honest and candid with each other if their views are going to be on the front page of a newspaper or a magazine the next day or the next week. But she's also saying that some of the leaks were harmful, that information came out which was helpful to competitors and such, and that she had every right and responsibility as chairman of the board to try to determine who was doing the leaking, even though we now know, of course, that the means used to find those leaks were problematic, and why there are now congressional hearings and various prosecutors across the country looking into possible indictments.
Right. The hearing is before the House Energy and Commerce Committee. It features testimony, as you said, by chair people, the current CEO. And it's said to be broader than just this one company scandal, you know, a greater examination of just some of those techniques that you were talking about, some of those questionable investigation practices. Have hearing members asked about some of those practices, for instance, pretexting?
Well, they're in pretexting the notion of impersonating the individual whose phone records you want. You know, if they want to get my phone records, a private investigator calls up, pretends to be me, and finds it pretty easy, at least so far, to get my phone records. Once you have my home phone records, you can figure out who I might be leaking to or who might be leaking to me. But other companies have certainly not been implicated. Congress, of course, being the body that writes laws, is trying to get a picture of how extensive this is in corporate America. But for the moment, they are focusing exclusively on Hewlett-Packard. Congress
has been interested in pretexting and other invasions of privacies from corporate America, from private investigators, has been interested in that now for more than a year. But it's this scandal at one of America's iconic companies, the company that really gave birth to Silicon Valley, it's this scandal that really allows Congress, through these hearings, for example, to make some political hay of this and get some attention. The prior hearings have not yet resulted in legislation that would increase the privacy rights of Americans and clearly make pretexting a federal crime. It's not clear that pretexting is a federal crime. It clearly is in states like California, but the web of regulation and legislation out there doesn't always address conduct that you and I would agree is bad behavior and unethical, but it may not be criminal.
Well, yet. And that brings me to, in the minute we have, the last question. So far, there has been no legal action against Hewlett-Packard executives. Do you expect that might change?
Yeah, I think at some point, probably from the California Attorney General first, although there are other prosecutors involved, I think you will see indictments of some combination of HP officials, these outside private investigators, and perhaps of HP itself. If you want to make an example of a company, if you want to get pretexting on the front page, there's no better way to do it than to indict an American icon.
Well, and how damaging has even the speculation been for that icon on the other side?
It's certainly been embarrassing, but the stock price has been pretty much constant. The company so far, I think, except for public relations, has been bulletproof. Now, a week ago, the stock price went down 5% when it became clear that Mark Hurd, the current CEO, who has now become also chairman of the board, replacing Patty Dunn, was more involved than people had thought of previously. But the stock price has rebounded a little bit since then. And even today, the stock price is holding constant. So far, however embarrassing this all is, certainly hasn't affected the company's fundamentals yet.
David Kaplan, senior editor of Newsweek magazine, on the Hewlett-Packard hearings today in Washington. David, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And one says to the rest, we must just watch our chance and escape one by one, though the fight is no more done than the war is in France. These are just a few of the lines from War Thoughts at Home. It was written by poet Robert Frost in 1918. It tells the story of a woman who hears the sounds of birds fighting at her window. She rises from her chair to watch and immediately thinks of World War I. The poem was written not long after Frost's friend and fellow poet Edward Thomas was killed in that war, but it lay undiscovered until last year when University of Virginia grad student Robert Stilling came across the work, and now it's going to be published in the Virginia Quarterly Review this Monday. Robert Stilling joins us on the line. How did you find this poem?
I was digging around in the University of Virginia Special Collections Library, and I found some letters referring to an unpublished poem and went looking for the source, and it happened to be in an early edition of Frost's second volume of poetry, North of Boston.
And he had sort of handwritten this on a couple of pages of that book?
Exactly, yes.
What powerful words, the fight is no more done than the war is in France. Can you just give us a few more of the lines that follow?
Then the war is in France. She thinks of a winter camp where soldiers for France are made. She draws down the window shade, and it glows with an early lamp. On that old side of the house, the uneven shed stretched back, shed behind shed in trains, like cars that have long lain dead on a side track.
What did you think when you read this?
It was the last image that really grabbed me. It's a bleak image. It's an image of an unsettled landscape.
It resonated with me, but do you think it's good?
You know, I've been living with the poem for about a year now, and I'm so familiar with it that I can't really get far enough away from it to judge it like that. I'll be very interested to see what Frost's many fans and what the many other Frost scholars out there think of it.
Robert Stilling, a University of Virginia grad student who came across this previously unpublished Robert Frost poem. Robert, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, earlier we mentioned rumors about Republicans lowering gas prices to gain votes. An oil analyst poo-pooed the notion, but a new Gallup poll says that 42% of Americans believe that the Bush administration is lowering gas prices to give Republicans an edge in November. For doubters, it fits neatly into the concept of the October surprise. Online blogs are abuzz with speculation that Bush advisor Karl Rove has a big October surprise planned. Rove isn't denying it, but he also won't say what it might be. He tells the website Newsmax, "I'd rather let the balance of plans for the elections unroll on its own." On another blog, Gary Hart weighs in. The former Democratic presidential candidate speculates the Bush administration might strike Iran before Americans head to the polls. Well, Julian Zelitzer is a professor of history at Boston University. Julian, this has become common in the run-up to an election, talk of an October surprise.
Yeah, it's ironic we still call it a surprise. I think at this point, every October, we expect something to happen that's going to move politics one way or another coming from the administration.
Tell us why. I mean, remind us of some of the October surprises in the past.
There's many famous ones. In 1968, Lyndon Johnson, the president, announced an end to bombing in Vietnam, and some said that gave a temporary boost to Hubert Humphrey's candidacy. At the same time, they say Nixon was working through back channels to tell the Vietnamese they'd get a better deal under his presidency.
Yeah. And the phrase was actually coined by George H.W. Bush when he was Ronald Reagan's running mate in 1980 against President Jimmy Carter. Let's remind ourselves, this is when Americans were being held hostage in Iran. Tell us more about the derivation of the word.
Yeah, in 1980, Reagan officials were convinced that the president, Jimmy Carter, was going to have a release of the hostages in Iran right before the election, guaranteeing him a re-election. And this was something they talked about. They talked about in public. And in the end, it didn't happen. And others say that Reagan worked to make sure that didn't happen.
There are those who say that, in fact, George H.W. Bush went to Iran, that there was some sort of negotiation with the Iranians not to release the hostages. This was, you know, some people hold this as fact. And that began the Iran-Contra relationship.
Exactly. And this would come out even more in the hearings in 1986 about Iran-Contra, and it gained a little more legitimacy as a result. So that's an example where an October surprise does not happen, but it became integral to kind of the political battle in October and November.
Because the expectation that it would. Well, so what do you think about this talk now, this upcoming October, that Karl Rove has an October surprise planned? He's, of course, thought to be a political mastermind. It'd be sort of exceptional if he didn't have something planned, wouldn't it?
Of course. Every administration is going to try to do things in October and September to build support for the party in power in the White House and in Congress. So it's not really a surprise. It's an attempt, as politicians always do, to move issues in their favor.
Well, you know, I could just see lawmakers going back and forth between, well, this would be good for us, oh, but wait, it might backfire if people thought we manipulated it. Let's say, for instance, Osama bin Laden was discovered in October. Can you almost see politicians saying, well, maybe we shouldn't announce it now because it might be thought we did this purposely?
Absolutely. I mean, going back to 1980, one of the reasons Ronald Reagan spoke about an October surprise was so that if anything happened, people would question it and think, is this political? Were the hostages in Iran released because Carter was playing politics? So I think right now politicians would be equally confused with some big event, including Republicans, about how best to handle it.
Yeah. Another example of an October surprise before we let you go. It was Henry Kissinger in 1972. Tell us more about
that. Who promised that peace was at hand in Vietnam and suggested very strongly that if Nixon was reelected, the whole war in Vietnam would come to an end and that negotiations were going well. That's a famous promise that some say boosted Nixon's popularity in that 72 landslide.
Julian Zelitzer, I'm flashing a warning sign here. We're just going to ask you to just go way out on that limb and just say, what are some of the things that might happen and wouldn't surprise you this fall?
Oh, obviously some big victory in the war on terrorism. It doesn't have to be the capture of bin Laden. It could be a series of al-Qaeda operatives or some big development in Iraq that all of a sudden makes it look like peace is at hand. That's another thing. And oil prices dropping dramatically. It's not so much a surprise, but it would be a nice gift to the Republican Party. Those are some of the things that can happen. I usually don't think these things move politics in one way or another, but that's what you'd be looking for.
Professor Julian Zelitzer teaches history at Boston University. Julian, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And for more on October surprises, just to, you know, bone up on your history, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Alto saxophonist Kenny Garrett has long been drawn to Asian culture and music. His most recent CD, Beyond the Wall, was inspired by a trip to China last year. The nine tracks pull sounds from John Coltrane to Tibetan monks to the Southern gospel that form the backbone of American jazz. And Kenny Garrett is here to tell us more about those sounds. Welcome.
How are you doing today, Rob?
Real good. What's this track we're listening to?
This is called Chin Wen.
Chin Wen. What does it mean?
Actually, Chin Wen means may I. In the text that I use, it changes. But actually, if you say Chin Wen, it would be something. But the way we sing it, it changes the tone and the meaning of it.
Did you learn that you took away about the music? Because not just an African American in a largely Asian culture, but a jazz artist. I mean, how did they react to that?
Well, actually, I stayed away from the places that people knew me. I did go to one hotel, and the musician, Chinese musicians, they recognized me. But even the singer who was from England didn't recognize me, and they ran off the stage, and she was like, "Who is this guy?" And they ran to their cars and got their CD.
They had your CD?
They had my CD. You know, which I was shocked. You know,
what did you take from Chinese sound, though? I mean, are they playing music that sounds just like American jazz? So why bother? Or was there something you found new?
What I found is that there was some music that they were doing by Mao Zedong that I was thinking, wow, this is interesting melodies. And some people were exposing me to some music that I never would have known, you know, where to look for it. So I would just go to bookstores, to record stores, and just ask for music. And I came back with a ton, you know, tons of music. And the thing is that the music is not like, I mean, they're actually learning how to play jazz, but Chinese music is Chinese music. Mm. You know, I mean, you can, if you listen to Chen Wen, you hear the influence and the melodies and the, I'm using like the pentatonics and the four voicings, you will hear that, but it's a sound that they have that, you know, the instruments, and like on Sonani's song where I use the arhu, which is a two-string violin. It was actually more of that that I gathered when I was there, but I didn't have enough time to put it together.
Well, in fact, we have a Tsunami song. Let's listen to a little of that. You mentioned the arhu?
Arhu.
Arhu.
Yeah.
Which is this instrument, and you can hear it here. What we also hear on this song, and it's so beautiful, is you playing piano.
That's correct. That's correct.
Is something you've done for a while? Or
Actually, I've been playing piano kind of just in my own living room, but there have been a lot of pianists who've actually told me that I need to record a CD playing piano.
Well, and you dedicate this new CD to McCoy Tyner, of course, the famed pianist for John Coltrane, a pianist in his own right. And some bloggers and others, I was reading around, are saying, even though he's not on the CD, he is all over this CD.
That's right. That's
what
right.
does that mean to you, that he's, McCoy Tyner is all over this CD?
Well, his spirit is there. If when I play the songs, if you heard it, you would say that's McCoy. But the spirit of Coltrane and McCoy Tyner is definitely in the music. You know, you can't avoid it. I mean, even
What is it? What is it?
Well, I mean, even in Chin Wen, you would hear, like, he was doing music in the 70s and 80s. It had, like, the voices and, you know, the African influence on that. Sometimes I call McCoy a Chinese piano player, you know, just when I'm talking to my friends, you know. But it's just the spirit that he brings to the music.
Well, tell us more of that. What does that mean, a Chinese piano player?
Well, you know, sometimes, you know, like, when I hear McCoy reach for the bottom note, I think of it as a gong. You know, you hear the gong go, boom, and McCoy will go, boom, and they'll play the next chord. So, I mean, I joke about it. I'm not saying I have any proof that that's, you know, true, but, you know, I just like to think of, you know, that, you know, when he was with his experience with Coltrane, they were probably checking out some, you know, some Asian music at some point. I know they checked out Japanese for sure.
Well, and you probably know this because a good friend of yours is Pharoah Sanders.
That's
also,
right.
As you say, stood on the stage with Coltrane, plays on this CD. Did that also bring part of that spirit of Coltrane to the CD?
Well, I definitely did. But we, Pharaoh and I, we play similar. So, like on The Calling, you know, we were playing together. It wasn't really planned to do that because that song was a feature Pharaoh. But I was trying to, you know, to edge it on to another place. So he was playing it, and I just kind of came in, and he thought, well, maybe I'm supposed to stop. And I was trying to get him to go, meaning to continue to go. I mean, he would play some notes that I would play, and I was like, wow, I can't play those notes. So it made me have to play some different notes.
You just gave us such insight into what it's like to have, you know, two horn players on the front line, each thinking, oh, geez, are you going to play? We think it's more organized than that. You know, it's not, right?
No, it was. That definitely was organized. It was just, you know, and I mean, even like the session in itself, like on most records, people have a tendency to say, okay, you're going to play two courses, you're going to play three courses around, you know, the structure of the tune. And I just said, well, whatever, however long you want to play, once you finish, then that's the next soloist. You know, and just to keep it, I wanted everybody to be inspired.
It is a very inspirational. It feels very, people have used the word spiritual. Or is that reaching too far? Is that
actually,
too literal?
The premise of the CD when I was going in is that I wanted to find a way to have people to think about God. And that we are distracted by a lot of things in life. And sometimes we don't reflect. So I figured if I could have people just reflect, maybe the first five songs. You know, maybe I really want the whole CD, but I figure if I can just pull them in for just a short amount of time just to reflect, you know, because we don't do that anymore, you know. And I'm not trying to be some religious person, but I just think that that was the premise of this CD.
I want to listen to the song that has a Tibetan monks singing in it. It's called what?
Realization Marching Towards Light.
Where'd you record this?
Actually, it's a sample. A friend of mine gave me a CD, and then when I was, you know, thinking about the title of the CD and what I wanted to do, I said, well, let me go back and review that. And so I went to a friend's house, and I said, well, I need you to sample this. This is a short piece, because I want to make music to it. And then I sampled it, went in the studio, and so we came up with this version of it.
Kenny Garrett's most recent CD is called Beyond the Wall. It was inspired by a trip to China and the Great Wall. What'd you think of the wall?
Oh, it was beautiful. You know, actually, I wasn't going to go to the Great Wall. It was in December, and it was freezing outside. And so they would say it's going to take 2 hours to walk the wall. We did it in about 45 minutes because it was too cold. But once I got up, you know, to the top, I mean, it was really like I was touching the sky. It was just beautiful looking down, and I was just so happy that I went. You know, it was just overwhelming. I was on my cell phone trying to call people in America. I'm on the Great Wall, you know. So it was a beautiful experience.
Kenny Garrett, his latest CD, again, Beyond the Wall. For more information about the CD and Kenny's tour schedule, go to our website, here-now.org. Kenny Garrett, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.